This is Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
JBL Tour Pro 3 earbuds are for those who don't conform to the standard.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to get into some touchscreen technology, how about the smart charging case, clear sound? These are not standard things. You're only going to get them with the JBL Tour Pro 3, baby.
And I love the sound of JBL when it goes... These earbuds are packed with innovation because you can't stand out by following others.
Touchscreen smart charging case for one-touch control, instant EQ customization, true adaptive noise canceling, and the one-of-a-kind audio transmitter, which can plug and play with everything from game consoles to in-flight entertainment. What more could you want? First doesn't follow. Grab a pair at JBL.com.
On the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. More terms apply.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 17, Episode 7, in which Bob had a conversation with Tasha, Elizabeth Daly Ayers, one of the victims in this case's daughter. And they had a very, very helpful, very compassionate conversation. We had a lot of comments and questions from our listeners. We are unfortunately sans Zach today, but we do have a lot to get to. So before we dive into all of that, do we have any housekeeping?
The only real housekeeping I have is that I do have West Memphis 3 news. I just got it last night.
Okay.
The evidence is at the lab.
Oh, I made it to the lab.
It made it to
Great.
The lab. It was so...
Oh, now I wish Zach were here for extra, because he'd be so happy. Let's make sure we tell him.
So I actually talked to Damien on the phone last night, and it just, like, he sounds so good. He's so... Because, you know, he's had the rug yanked out from under him so many
times. Of course.
And the 10 days went by, and we talked last time, and it hadn't been sent, and nobody really knew what was going on, and I think he was just feeling like it's not going to happen again. It's not going to happen again. Apparently, all it was, remember I had told you guys at the hearing, there was discussion about how the evidence would be packaged. Apparently, all it was the prosecutor had to, like, you know, file orders and supplements and saying, okay, we're using this courier and we're doing it this way. And there was, it just delayed things a little bit, but it got shipped out, and we got word yesterday afternoon that the evidence has hit the lab and testing is commencing. So,
oh my goodness.
It was so good to hear Damien's voice yesterday, just sounding just so just excited. Like, it was like the first time I've talked to him in a long time through this process where he hasn't been just like that hesitant, like, they're going to screw me over. They're going to screw me over. They're going to screw me over. And I also just had one of those moments too, like, as I was talking to him, I still think of all the people, because we're hopefully going to get a real answer to this case.
God, I hope
real soon. It's like, this is it. I think this is really going to be it. And I think of all the people that are out there that are still, like, insisting and just hating and saying horrible things and insisting that Damien, Jason, and Jesse are guilty despite all the evidence to the contrary. And I just had this moment where I was like, is there really nothing inside of them that thinks that Damien in particular has been fighting this hard for this many years to get this evidence sent to a place where they'll do the most, like, thorough possible job to draw out any singular cell of DNA from this evidence to prove who did it? Is there any part of your brain that thinks, huh, that's weird for a guilty guy to do who's already free and doesn't need to do it? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I wish I could say, yes, that part exists, and maybe it does with some people. But I think this case in particular, not that there aren't many, many more like it, But for me personally, and I bet I speak for a lot of our listeners, for me personally, the West Memphis case was the most jarring exposure to that cognitive dissonance in true crime than I think I'd ever seen, and remains like a landmark example of that, of like, oh, I see, this has to be about something else because it can't be about the facts.
It doesn't make any sense.
It's really, I'm sure they'll study this for that reason, along with all of the others, for decades to come.
Yeah. And even with result, like legitimate results that are able to hopefully, you know, put the right person in prison, I guarantee some of these people will still continue that cognitive dissonance.
Oh, I think almost all of them will.
Yeah, probably all of them. It's just, I don't know. Like I said, it doesn't matter anymore. It just occurred to me. I don't know why that just popped in my head. I'm like, how can you really, like, really think, yeah, this guy did it? And because, you know, those same people, when we started pushing for this, you know, in 2020, were just like, it's just a publicity stunt. He doesn't really want to test it. And it's like, oh, he filed an appeal all the way up to the Arkansas Supreme Court to get it done. Like, oh, well, what's going on here? And then the thing that when we got denied in 2022, and then like filing, going back up to the Arkansas Supreme Court again to push it, and then like just hoop after hoop after hoop and pushing, and it finally gets to the lab and they're like, yeah, it's totally, that's a guilty, like, what's the, and it doesn't matter. I don't even want to get into it, but it was just one of those moments I had where it's like, what's wrong? And as I've said with most cases, and I accept this even with the West Memphis 3 case, I can fully accept somebody being like, man, I still think they're guilty. Like, I can acknowledge that, you know, there's a chance, but I still think they're guilty. Like that, I can get that.
Right.
But like the people that are like, absolutely, like, and no matter what new evidence comes out, like, that doesn't matter. It's still like, it's, yeah. Like
it's about said, something
it's
else.
It's about something else.
It's about something else. Well, do we have any sense? I'm sure people, that's everyone's next question is just, you know, do we have any sense of how long it will take to have public results revealed?
No, we don't. I was actually asking Damien about that last night because, you know, at one point it was going to go to Pure Gold in forensics, and they were like, we're going to run, like, the minute it hits our desk, we're going for it, and we're going to have results back in a couple of weeks. It ended up going to Bodie, and that was because you got a lot of players now, right?
So
you got the prosecutor, you've got Jason's team and Jesse's team and Damien's team. So they ended up going to, everybody agreed on Bodie.
Right.
And so he was saying that, like, for the MVAC, like, it all has to go to Bodie, but, like, Bodie's able to subcontract someone else to do the MVAC because apparently it sounded like, from what Damien was telling me, they had found like this a really good expert that they were really excited about using to do the MVAC extraction, and that person they're not part of Bodie, and so they're hoping that Bodie can then still contract, I think it's a woman, her, to come and do the extraction piece. So there may be a little bit of a, you know, it may take a little bit of time to get all the pieces put together. But then whatever gets extracted, the analysis of that DNA will be at Bodie Labs. Everything's going to happen at Bodie Labs, but they can bring other people in. So yeah, we don't have any like hard and fast like timeline. I would imagine that Bodie knows, like, all eyes across the world are watching right now, and do it as quickly as possible, but all we really care about is that they do it as thoroughly and correctly as possible.
Sure. Yeah, this would be the wrong time to push something through speedily when so much time has passed. You just want to get it right.
Veronica in the YouTube chat said that she Googled yesterday and it said that the results would be in 2026. So that tracks, you know, because we're coming into September.
Yeah.
So, you know, that would be, you know, in 4 months, it'll be 2026. So it wouldn't surprise me if it takes... But I would expect either towards the end of the year or like Q1 2026 next year that we'll have the results, is what I'm hoping for.
Which is more around the corner than I would care to believe, considering how fast this year has gone. But that's, I guess, the good part is it will feels like a long time now, but I bet it won't feel that long once it actually happens.
Right.
That's all hope. Well, thanks for that update. That's very exciting.
Yeah. And so getting back into this episode, first of all, I personally, and I did to her personally, but just, you know, publicly, just want to really thank Tasha for coming on and doing the interview. That was hard. You know, I'd mentioned that I'd been talking to her for a couple of weeks, and I'm sure there was a lot of nervousness there about, you know, she said from the very beginning when we first talked that, you know, she did want to she wanted to come on the podcast because she wanted to give her mother a voice and she wanted people to hear from her perspective. But man, that's a lot to ask of someone to do. And I was just so impressed. And she did so well. And she just did great. And it just added a layer to this story that I don't think we could have gotten any other way other than having Tasha come on and tell her mom's story.
I agree. And that was a very consistent thread that ran through all of the Facebook posts when people would chime in with questions and stuff. Just an overwhelming amount of people who really wanted to make sure to take that moment to say thank you to Tasha for being vulnerable in that way and for sharing that part of her life and her mom and her memory with us and to entrust us with that. Because it is hard when nobody's perfect. And it's very hard to want to help as much as you can, knowing also that you're acknowledging something that is a tough part of your life and your history, if not the toughest, which I'm sure it is, for all of those reasons. And also people who thought you did a lovely job of navigating that. So credit where credit is due. You handled it very, very gently and thoughtfully. And those are really important things to our listeners, which is one of the reasons that we love them so much.
Absolutely. I saw a lot of those comments and we have such a kind and open-minded audience. And that was one of the things that I told Tasha, you know, coming in, it was like, this group of people, I know it's like thousands of people all over the world, but like, they're here with us because they have the same type of mindset towards these type of things. And another big thing is, as far as, you know, moving the case forward and getting information that's going to help us with the case, one thing that tends to be a struggle a lot of times when we're trying to actually study victimology is everybody wants to, you know, to look through rose-colored glasses, right? And just paint like a better picture than maybe reality sometimes. So that was not easy either for Tasha. You know, she could have come on and just been like, she was wonderful. She was the best. There was never any problems. And I'm sure there's like an instinct to do that, but that doesn't help us. You know, because one thing in our private conversations that we had off the air, you know, there was a lot of discussion about the fact that the police never cared enough to ask these questions.
Yeah.
And she wants, you know, she recognizes that the best way to be able to solve this case is going to be able to have all of the facts that the police never bothered to look for. So just, you know, hats off to Tasha for, like you said, making herself so vulnerable and giving us as thorough and honest as a picture of her mother as she could.
And also, and Tasha, if you're listening to this, I'll say this directly to you. You know, this kind of thing has sometimes a result that you don't expect, which is the way that these things sort of blossom out into other discussions. And so much of what we also saw on the follow-up, not just in the Facebook, but I think in just general posts, is people feeling very seen, very heard, and very understood about struggles that they have had in their own lives and that they have had. Uh-oh, I'm getting emotional. That their family members have had, because so many of us have been touched by addiction. And we had so many people saying, you know, thank you, Tasha, for, you know, being brave enough to help us and Bob for giving a platform for that continued conversation about addiction being a disease, not being about, oh, your mom just didn't care enough about you, so she just wasn't there for you. It is so much more complicated than that. And it is, an addiction is so real. And especially for those of us who have watched a family member keep getting back up and trying over and over again, it is heartbreaking. And I just wouldn't wish that on anyone. And so the fact that people feel, Tasha, that you're, you know, not only do we want to find the person responsible for this, but also you and your mom have had an impact on people that goes far beyond just this one case, because people feel like they've been seen and heard. And they feel like the more we can talk about this stuff, the more we can help the people who are suffering through it.
Whew. Yeah, I agree 100%.
Sorry about that.
No, that's fine.
Very emotional.
That's, again, our audience, I think, is they appreciate the fact that this really means that much to you. And yeah, and you've just touched a lot of people, Tasha. And with that being said, we better get into stuff. Get into the questions, there was, were there any specific takeaways that you had or thoughts that you had about the episode, Janet, before we get into the questions?
No, I mean, I thought it was really important for all the reasons that we've just talked about, certainly for understanding, you know, Liz better as a human being and hopefully ways in which that will contribute towards the investigation. I knew that we were going to get questions across the board about all of the things that you guys touched on. And so I didn't make a bunch of notes for myself. The only thing that I thought that kind of jumped out at me at the time as I was listening to it, which I'm acknowledging right now that it's just as likely that it would be something that would be, that you'll hear what I mean in a moment, a comment that Tasha made that could very much be informed by present day facts and information. But she did happen to say that, you know, when she was talking to the police, at some point they said, like, if you want us to catch these guys, like that was just like what she sort of threw out there as a comment. And I just peeked to that immediately because I thought, well, if they really said that, yeah, then, you know, it's like they knew. But it's possible that, you know, because of what she has come to understand about the case, or, you know, maybe that's just something that she felt and knew. And, you know, she attributed that logic, the basic logic that you would imagine the cops would use, whether they used it or not. I just thought that that just struck me, you know.
Well, yeah. And I'm sure they did actually think that. That's one of the infuriating parts about this case, because remember, like, their initial, you know, clues were from Larry saying that there was like two people there talking to them.
Right.
Like that was like in the initial statements that there was two men had come and had a conversation. So they were always looking for two. The evidence they presented at trial was all about two. It was always two people. But then they convicted. And again, it shows you how much did they actually care about these victims, because they convicted one.
Yeah.
And then case closed.
Yeah.
Never convicted a second person, never arrested a second person for it, never, you know, never put anybody else on trial for it.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't surprise me at all if that is exactly what they said, because what the information they had was that there was two men in the house.
Yeah. But and the idea that you would say that to the victims' families, kind of using their emotions to, which, by the way, they weren't getting any, you know, they weren't even coming to her for any information at the time. So it's not like, but, you know, you sort of hear that and you think, gosh, that's such an easy thing to say to a victim's family when you're, you know, trying to get a case solved. But you take that in as a family member, and you think that really means that the police care about the case and that they're going to never give up until they've found the people responsible. And then to just see it kind of go in a direction and then disappear, be like, but remember when you said you really wanted to solve this? I don't know.
And really what I wanted you to do was to shut up and get out of my way.
Yeah, it's painful. And I know there's going to be so much more to dig in about that, because obviously we haven't heard the, you know, the confession. And there's just so much about the way this case was built out and how it all came down that we don't know yet. But and obviously every episode that you release pushes us forward into wanting more of those answers as we go. So there will undoubtedly be some things that come up today as well that you just have to tell us that we have to hold on, and that there will be more coming and that you don't know the answer to yet as you move through this investigation.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
'Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
So for the first question, just kind of looking for a hard fact here, if you have it. Ari says, I know you said the ages in the autopsy episodes, but can you remind us how old Amp and Liz were when they were killed?
Oh, I wish I had seen that question. They were, I want to say 37. I believe they were, did you say Amp and Angela?
Amp and Liz, in the case of Ari's question.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, I believe, I'll figure this out and make sure I let you know later next week. But because I believe they were both 37, but one of the victims was 34. So either 34 or 37. They were in their mid-30s.
Okay. Amy says if her daughter, she said a few other things, including being very kind about Tasha. But Amy said, was just curious, wasn't sure if she had missed this somewhere else. If Tasha didn't identify Liz, then who did? How do they know who she was?
Yeah, so it was another family member and a friend. There was two people that went. One was, she mentioned Donna. And I believe that the way that worked was they interviewed Michelle, because remember, Michelle is the one that had reported her missing. They interviewed Michelle. Michelle had given them details about Liz and Sheila. You know, she mentioned the tattoos, the fact that Liz was missing a tooth. And then I think that Michelle, that we're going to get into Michelle's statement later, her actual police statement. But I think that Michelle had like told them, you know, who some of her friends or family were, who they got a hold of, and then they had them go down and positively identify the bodies or her body. They had, yeah, that's as well as Sheila, same type of thing.
Got it. Laura says, did you ask Tasha what her mother was wearing when she last saw her? I'm wondering whether it was what Liz was wearing when she was found.
No, I didn't. But I am going to I saw that question. I'm going to reach out to Tasha and see if she remembers. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a long shot, but if it's something that's really burned into her mind, she may know.
Yeah. Some questions around the car. I figured this would happen during that conversation because there were things that I think we haven't gotten to yet that were referred to in your conversation with Tasha, including questions about, yeah, whose car it was. Kaylee says, Liz's daughter was talking about the car her mom would borrow from Tom. Did we know that she drove somewhere that night using his car? For some reason, I had pictured her walking to Michelle's house/apartment, but maybe she drove there. It felt like new information to me, but I could have just been filling gaps in my own head.
No, she drove. So the car that was found at the ball field was, because that was a question that had come up a while ago. People were like, because in the photos, there's like the registration who it belongs to and says it belongs to someone named Tom.
Yeah.
But that was the car Liz was driving. It was Liz's neighbor or somebody that lived near her, you know, where she lived over in Portage or whatever, 10 minutes away. Yeah. And she drove from her house to Michelle's house and then left in her car. I think some of the confusion came in because of the keys, you know, because you know, Michelle said that, you know, she left with her keys. Those weren't car keys. She had given Liz and Sheila her house keys so that when they came home, they could get back into the house while she was sleeping.
Got it.
And then she was upset the next day because on that same key ring were Michelle's car keys. So Michelle was stranded because she didn't have her car keys. But they didn't take Michelle's car. Liz was driving Tom's car.
Okay. That's very helpful, actually. I'm realizing now that I forgot. I didn't think that they were driving her car. Do you need to pause for a second?
Yeah, sorry. I was distracted. I was trying to answer the question. People were asking how old were Liz and Amp at the time of the murder. So I was pulling up on my other monitor the autopsy reports. And I do have that answer. So Amp was 35 years old and Liz was 37 years old at the time of the murders.
Okay.
Didn't mean to derail you.
No, it's fine. That clarification about the keys, because it would make sense that someone would think that she was driving Michelle's car since Michelle's car key was on the key ring that they only had because they were going to be able to get back into the house. So that's helpful.
Yeah.
And then Emmett had a question about the club, which made several of us on the follow-up thread realize, like, oh, you may take, we took for granted that people would necessarily know what the club is, because it could mean any number of things. It could mean a bully club. Like, it could mean something that you would imagine like a baseball bat that you would use for defense. It could mean any number of things. In this case, I'm assuming that you were talking about the club, which was like an as seen on TV kind of device that I'm sure people still use, but it's sort of meant to keep you from being able to, like, steal a car. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a security device. And the way it works, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, maybe people are younger than me and Janet and didn't see all those as seen on TV commercials. But yeah, it's like a steel rod, maybe 3/4 inch diameter, pretty heavy rod. And it's like telescoping. And inside the rod, there's two hooks that both face outward. And the way it would work, and then it's like coated in like rubber. And the way it would work is you would put it over your steering wheel and extend the rod out so that those hooks capture like both sides of the steering wheel. So it's stuck on the steering wheel. And the rod would then extend up to like where it's like touching the windshield. And the effect that it had was you couldn't turn this if you were to steal the car or hot wire or whatever. You couldn't turn the steering wheel because this rod is jammed into the steering wheel into the windshield. So you can't turn the steering wheel to drive it away. And that's what she was talking about. And she said that Tom would often put the club on his car so that Liz wouldn't take his car.
Right. That makes sense. So that's what the club was. And very effective, by the way. I mean, my memory of it is like, well, that's, if you're worried about your car being taken without your permission, it's a pretty big item. What came up for me on that, and I can't remember if you guys touched on this during the episode with the interview itself, but is that something that could have been used as a weapon?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that was when she mentioned that as first thing, because remember, I think I'd even mentioned the club as a possibility.
Oh, maybe you did. Then. Maybe you did. Yeah.
And I don't know if that was from the kind of leakage for me, if I had heard somebody mention something about it at some point as maybe why it got into my head. But I believe based on that injury and the way the skull fractured and the way the skin tore, my theory has been that it was some kind of a long tubular object. So I thought like a pipe, the club, something like that. This would definitely fit that bill. It's something that you could swing hard enough that would hit and cause the skull fracture, but also tear the skin.
Yeah.
So that's definitely a possibility. And the club was not found in the car or at the crime scene. So, we don't know for sure if it was in there when she took it. But according to Tasha, it was that Tom always kept it in that car.
Yeah.
Like when she'd see her mom driving that car, the club was in the car. So
yeah, that's really her testimony on that, if you want to call it that, is pretty compelling. Everyone I've ever known who had a club never took it out of the car. There was no reason to.
Right.
You would always have it in the car. So that's very, very interesting. Okay. Rebecca says, Tasha mentions that she heard about the murder from Sharon and Naomi, friends of Liz's and hers. It sounds like they knew about the murder pretty quickly, during a window when police would have been IDing the body so early. While it's possible Sharon and Naomi heard about the murders from the media, I'm wondering how much initial coverage these murders would have received, since Gary had a serious crime problem, and maybe it was treated as just more of the same, in quotes. Or, per Tasha's remarks, the detective thought of her mom as one of those types of people, also in quotes. So where did Sharon and Naomi learn about the murder? Could they have been part of the street network, the so-called street network, that may have known something about who could really have done it? And are those people around and willing to speak with you?
They're added to my list of people that I want to speak to. I don't know how they found out, but it wouldn't have been from the media, because it's someone they're just identifying the body. So even if there was like massive media coverage of what had happened, it wouldn't have been that Elizabeth Daly Ayers was murdered. It would have been just there's two bodies found at the ballpark. So there's no way they would have known that it was her. So my assumption, a lot of it to me probably comes back to Michelle. Because remember, Michelle said that she spent some time before she called the police calling around to all Liz's friends, trying to see if anybody had seen her and or knew where she was at.
Okay.
So my assumption is that she was probably the source of the information.
Interesting. And questions about Tom, including from Jennifer. Do you know if he would be someone that you could speak with?
I believe Tom is deceased.
Him. Okay.
And then in our YouTube chat, Donna said the police never talked to Tom about it. Like, and from what I've seen so far in the case file, because that's how a lot of this you know, when I'm investigating, writing episodes and stuff like this, that's a lot. You know, I go down these rabbit trails.
Sure.
And I start, you know, keyword searching all these documents, trying to find, and I haven't seen anywhere where Don was ever questioned, which is
Tom.
Nuts.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
Or I said Don, yeah. Tom, I meant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Okay, Becky, and I'm going to read Becky's, but this a lot of very similar related questions came in from people like Patricia and Rossi said, is there any evidence that AMP might have dealt? Whether it be crack or something else. Could it be possible, Becky asks, the people Liz and Sheila met at the ball field came to AMP's house earlier in the evening to obtain crack to sell to Liz, then returned after the murders because they told Amp, Angela, and Suzanne who they were meeting and selling to.
So I don't know. I did find this week when I was researching something else, some indication that Amp did sell drugs. I don't know if it's, I don't know if we'll be able to verify that or not. I'm hoping so. I've actually been in contact with Amp's son over the last couple of weeks. We've texted a few times. We've been, you know, planning to get on a phone call. It hasn't worked out. As of right now, we have scheduled to get on the phone and actually talk on Friday. So that won't be an interview. I'm just going to talk to him on Friday. I'm hoping that he will be open to coming on and doing an interview and talking about his dad and you know, just like Tasha did. As far as that scenario, I don't know. There's a lot of scenarios I've run through my mind, but the big thing that I keep coming back to is there were no drugs found at the scene. You know, it's possible that they, you know, that the killer took everything, but, you know, and it's the hard part is like the best witness account we have from what happened is from 12-year-old Larry. But then we know, and this is not me assuming, this is from his own words. What he has said later is that a lot of what he said is not true. And it sounds like he was pressured by police to insert things into that narrative. So I don't know where we draw the line of what's true and what's not true. If we believe his kind of initial account of what happened, which was that, you know, that two guys came in, they had some words, the shots were fired, they shut the lights off and left, like that doesn't, unless like whatever drugs Amp had that he was selling were just all laying right there, you know, you'd think they'd be somewhere where they'd have to like look for him and find him. It's hard to imagine that it happened that quickly. It's also hard to imagine. So based on what we learned in the talk screens, all three of the victims in the house used crack cocaine right before they were killed. So they were users of them. It would also seem odd that if they're, because, you know, there's the idea of like, well, maybe if he was a dealer, but he didn't actually smoke it, that's why they didn't have it in their system from any time before then. But they did use it right before they were killed. So it would seem odd. It seems to me more like it's the other way around, that they were, that Amp and Angela and Suzanne were getting the cocaine from the people that came in and killed them, not the other way around, because just based on the fact that there was none found anywhere in the house and there was no metabolites in their system indicating that they had used, you know, within a day or two before that either.
Yeah. I think we have some other questions about kind of behaviors leading up to and after the murder in the house. I'm just going to ask this question in case anyone else has it. I'm not saying that I think this is the case. Is there a scenario where you could see little Larry just like trying to look out for his people and trying to protect them and maybe gathering up something that he knows? Like, I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying I think that would happen. I think that's way too advanced and an incredibly traumatic, horrible situation. I cannot imagine that happening. I'm just going to ask it to like put it out there in case anyone else crossed anyone's mind.
No, I don't think so for a couple of reasons. One, like you said, he just walked into his mother.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's realistic.
Everybody loved. But on top of that, I'll share this a little bit with you. Part of what I've been researching, getting ready for, is to go through all of Larry's statements. And Larry, in his police statement, said that Amp dealt drugs, right? So it doesn't, that's when I said, like, I found one piece of evidence that indicates that maybe he did.
Okay.
That's what it was.
Okay.
It was Larry saying that he did. So yeah, it doesn't really compute to me that he would both just go tell the police, yeah, he does drugs after like hiding them so
absolutely.
They wouldn't know.
Absolutely. Okay, yeah. That's helpful. Thank you for that. Meanwhile, Kelsey says, what can Tasha tell us anything else about just kind of Amp's general demeanor and personality since they were friends?
She hasn't, but I can ask her that. But I'm hoping to get some of that too from Amp's son.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, we're going to. And I have some contact information for some family members of the other victims, some of the other victims too. So you know, my hope is if any of them are willing, you know, you'll hear more interviews like this if, you know, any of those people are willing, you know, if Amp's son is willing to come on and record an interview and talk about his dad, then, you know, as far as I'm concerned, number one, you know, I believe victimology is the most important part of any investigation. And it's also really important to me that these five victims don't get lost in this investigation and in this story. So it will stop all, you know, whatever I have planned that week. If Am says, yeah, I'm willing to get on and do an interview, then that's what you're going to hear that week. And we'll just push, we'll move the episodes back. So hopefully we'll get more of that information soon.
Okay. So Joan is, again, as people are continuing to really try to connect those dots and see if there is that connection between the crimes, which I'm sure for people seems now more likely, knowing that one victim in the house and one victim in the ball field certainly knew each other. Joan says, I'm wondering if perhaps Liz and Sheila showed up at the house during the murders and were killed to silence them after witnessing either the murders or the aftermath.
I don't think so, because there's a timing issue there, right? So we have the only timing we have for the murders at the ball field were the one witness. We'll get more into her testimony later, but I touched on it in episode one, that it was around like 1:20 in the morning when she was actually outside on her front porch and heard the gunshots at the ball field that night. And then it's somewhere around 2:05, 2:20, somewhere after 2 a.m. is when the murders happened. We know when they happened at the house because, you know, Larry went out and called 911 right afterwards. So it seems like the murders at the ball field happened 30 minutes to an hour before the murders at the house.
Okay. Sarah says, I'm not a drug user, but am skeptical that Liz would take someone she didn't know, Sheila, to meet a drug dealer. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't know. That's not a world that I'm very familiar with. I also don't know. I don't know much about Sheila yet at this point. You know, so like I don't know her personality because I haven't been able to connect with anybody that was close to Sheila at the time. You know, was she somebody who liked to party and was like, yeah, let's go get some stuff and go have a good time. I'm down for whatever. Or I don't know, the fact that she ate, I think, after they left too. Like all these things are still, so I don't have the answer for you yet. And I don't know if I'll be able to get the answer for you, but that's definitely something I thought of. Because if you remember, according to Michelle, it wasn't like she said, hey, me and Sheila are going out. She said, I'm going to liquor store. I want you to come with. And Michelle said, no, I'm already in bed. I'm done for the night. And then Sheila said, well, I'll go with you. So yeah, I don't know. Skeptical is not the right word for me. It's just kind of confusing for me still at this point, how all that shook out.
Yeah, it's very confusing because you can imagine any number of reasons and motivations for all kinds of stuff, all kinds of scenarios that kind of could be a piece of what you described and what Michelle said. I mean, if you're meeting a dealer that you would rather not see alone, that's a different conversation than, hey, right, do you want to get in on this? Or, you know, hey, do you want to, while we're out, you're hungry, we can grab you a bite to eat. I'll be real quick. Like there's so, it's like feels like infinite possibilities as to the motivations and reasoning and circumstances behind those two ladies leaving together.
Yeah.
That so far it doesn't seem like anyone bothered to get to the bottom of. So hopefully maybe we'll be able to elucidate some of that. Jessica says, maybe a strange question, but since Tasha said she would have, that Liz would already have had the cash for the drugs when going to the liquor store, do we know what kind of liquor store it was? I know there used to be those beverage stores that also sold alcohol that you could drive through and not get out of your car. Drive-thrus are notorious for being places drugs are sold out of. Was anyone spoken to at the liquor store?
Of course not. At least not that we see in the case file not that I've seen so far. And as far as I know, no, nobody was ever. That was one of the biggest frustrations, as I said, like, they never seemed to even bother to figure out what her movements were. But, you know, I'm sure you guys all heard in real time in that interview how much that hit me as I was trying to, you know, I've been thinking through a timeline and trying to make sense of all of this. And it was like that gap between all the way when we go to the ball field, right? So Liz is fully dressed. It looks to me as though someone was trying to pull her shirt off or tried to grab her by the shirt and she was, you know, pulling away from it or whatever. It certainly, that scene doesn't look to me like she went to go do sex work or trade sex work for drugs there. That does not seem to be the scenario. I'm still confused by, you know, Sheila then is, you know, fully nude. So that's a whole nother story. But none of that really made sense to me. Also, when eventually we're going to be getting into like the DNA in the case, all of the DNA evidence that came out after the conviction, it just a lot of not alarm bells, but a lot of lights started going off for me. Like, okay, now I can maybe see how this makes some sense.
Oh,
if she left, say, 6 o'clock, her house, And then there's a four hour gap there before she shows up at Sheila. According to Tasha, her MO would be to go do sex work to earn money and then go use that money to go get drugs. For some reason, I had in my mind that once Tasha had told me in my first conversation, because the information I had gotten was that there's no evidence that she's ever done any sex work. That was an excuse the prosecution used in an appeal later. And then Tasha was like, no, she did. She did do that. And so in my mind, it was like, okay, so maybe that's what was going on. She was trading sex work for drugs. And then when she told me that, no, that's not how it would work. She would trade sex work for money and then the money for the drugs. And I understand because some people had commented, they're like, that's very common to trade. I had people even email me that had suffered from addiction themselves. And like, it's not an uncommon thing to trade sex for drugs.
Right.
But I understand it's not an uncommon thing. But it sounds like that's not the way Liz operated.
Right.
So I think all that's this all makes sense, I think, later when we get into the DNA.
Okay. Going back to the house crime scene for just a moment, Sarah says, do we know if the children in the house were tested for any drugs, just in terms of whether it could help indicate whether they were habitual users around the kids?
I don't think so, no.
Janiyah says, again, going back, this is the comment that I mentioned earlier about going back to that sort of behavior around the consumption of drugs and then the subsequent murder. Janiyah says, why would a dealer supply, assumedly paying customers drugs, then shoot them all afterwards? Surely this isn't good business. Any dealer would get their money first before handing over the crack. So what motive is there? It also feels too messy if easily tied back to someone who supplied them drugs. I wonder if we are more likely thinking it could be an acquaintance who used the crack as just a way in the door, like a decoy.
I think that's possible, that it wasn't necessarily a dealer, that, especially because, again, if we're believing Larry, like it sounds like people came by the house, they had a conversation, they left, they came back, and then we know they did drugs, and then they were killed immediately afterwards. Doesn't sound like a dealer to me. It sounds more like an acquaintance. They came back and maybe the drugs were just a distraction to get everybody a little bit distracted before they murdered them. But as far as the motivation, that's a good question. And that goes back to, as we're starting to kind of break down things at the ball field, why it was so significant to me to realize, oh, the attack started somewhere else and then the bodies were moved in an attempt to conceal it. That's when we started thinking through, or I started thinking through, okay, why would they conceal these? But they know they're going to be found soon. Why are they concealing them? And then I started wondering about the connection to the crime scene. And that's it. I think I said at the end of that episode, the only thing that makes sense to me, if the scenes are connected, is the motive would be that the people at the house had seen them with Liz that night. So they're like, if Liz and Sheila's bodies are found, these three people at this house are going to tell police, like, they were with those two guys right there. That's who they left my house with an hour before this happened. So I think that would be, it's a theory, but I think that would be a motive that would make sense to me, would be that they are witnesses that could catch them for killing the other two.
Which, I mean, for those of us who are kind of coming from a place where we have never done anything like this, it seems crazy to increase your risk of getting caught by taking more lives to conceal the fact that you've taken lives. That's a massive risk, but that's not necessarily the mindset that you're in when this is all going down too.
I think if we break this, if we just look at it like logically, and I know that people in these situations aren't always thinking logically, but we kind of like tend to think instinctually, there's always going to be like this, like a cost benefit or a risk benefit analysis that's happening, whether it's really like carefully thought out or it's just something that's just automatically happening in your brain. So are they adding more risk by killing three more people? Yes. But at the same time, are they also removing some risk by killing those three people?
Right.
And so if the thought in their mind, and I know I'm talking about this kind of very academically, but just a basic thought in your mind is, we are 100% going to be caught because these three people know that we were with them.
Right.
And if it's like, but if we go kill those three people, now there's a 25% chance we get caught for all five, but there's a 75% chance we don't get caught for any of them.
Right.
Right. So there's that kind of balance. And like I said, I'm not suggesting that they were doing a statistical analysis of this, but just that kind of basic thought process.
Right.
Like, I know I'm caught if they're alive.
Right.
If I kill them, I might get caught for all five, but there's also a chance that I won't get caught at all because they're the only reason anyone would know I was with them.
Yeah. Oh, that's brutal, especially knowing that those kids are there. That really is, in terms of behavior, just extra heartless, it would seem, if you want to look at it that way. Okay, we're almost done. Jennifer and some others asked a similar question. I may have missed it, she says, but did Bob ask Tasha if she or Liz knew Chris Bynum or any Chris that her mom might have mentioned to Michelle?
Yeah, Liz didn't know Chris. Chris didn't know Chris Bynum at all.
Tasha didn't know.
Yeah, didn't know Chris at all. And so because I'd asked her, do you know? And she's like, I don't think so. I've never heard. I don't know this guy.
OK, so I guess it's still possible that Liz could have. But
it's possible. It. Yes.
And Ari said this may be jumping ahead. And Ari, you know, you're right. You were jumping ahead. But Ari asks, what do we know if Chris Bynum was a dealer or a user?
Not to my knowledge, definitely not a dealer. I don't know if he was a user. I've purposely not dug into Chris too much because I don't want to bias what I'm looking. I'm trying to look at the case from ground zero, from the very beginning, and see where the evidence has taken us. So I don't want to make the mistake they made as turning this into a suspect-driven investigation. So yeah, I don't know the answer to that yet. We'll be digging into, because if that's the case, you know, should have come out of trial, should have come out in the investigation. But I don't think so. I don't think that he was a user or a dealer, because that's certainly not like in like the big flashing, you know, headlines of anything you research or Google or anything. Look at this case. There's not like, you know, drug dealer killed, you know, there was none of that.
Yeah. Wow. Which makes all of these questions people have about the connection that Chris has at all even more like mysterious and something that people are very eager to learn more about. Tony says, kind of going back to last week's podcast, and apologies if this has been asked before, but could there have been one perpetrator who brought two guns to the house in the first incident? If they were flying solo and didn't want to waste time reloading, wouldn't this be an option?
Yeah, that's definitely a possibility. You know, we basically what we were able to determine in the house crime scene is that 8 shots were fired. They were almost certainly fired out of a revolver, which means it was almost certainly either two guns or a reload. I don't think that there was a reload. That just doesn't make sense to me. Although, you know, we do have Larry saying that he heard somebody saying to reload. So again, it's hard with, we don't know how much of Larry's story came from him and how much of it came from coercion, right? So it's possible there was a reload. It's possible it was one guy with two guns, and it's possible there was, you know, two different guys with two guns. I just have a hard time imagining what sequence of shots would happen to where they're going to take the time to reload a pistol. It's just hard for me to wrap my brain around. So yeah, there's all kinds of possibilities about that are still out there.
Okay. Are we going to talk more about all the ballistics and stuff?
Yeah, as a matter of fact. And on the topic of the firearms and the connections that we were talking about, that's what we're moving into this Sunday. I think that we now have, once we add in the firearm examiner's analysis, what we've already learned, and there's another witness we're going to hear from this week or hear about this week. I think that we should be finally be able to answer, because, you know, the question that was just being asked was, is there a connection to Chris? I don't know. But the first thing that we need to do is figure out, is there a connection between these two crime scenes? Is this a quintuple homicide or is it two separate, a triple and a double homicide? So that's the question we're going to answer this weekend. I think I've got I'm pretty comfortable saying it could come to a pretty definitive conclusion. I will also warn you, this, I think, will be the shortest episode that we've ever produced. So I started working on, you know, all these different angles that I knew I was going to go through. I was able to get through them, and again, much shorter than normal. And one, I was able to answer the question. Two, it's a holiday weekend, and I'm going to try to spend some time with the holidays, and we decided that that's what it's going to be. So I need your time for about 17 minutes on Sunday.
Okay.
And we're going to answer the connection question. And other than that, enjoy, if you're in the United States, your Labor Day weekend. And we'll talk to you guys all about it next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Casino. Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.